From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He cleans houses by day. He writes at night. On today's Fresh Air, we meet David Sedaris. He's been reading his journals on NPR's Morning Edition about his job as an elf in Santaland, why he won't stop smoking, and how he almost wrote for a magazine catering to men who like giant-sized women. He's a real original. Also today, fly fever, the African eyeworm, and other diseases that can afflict a world traveler. Just in time for your vacation, we talk with travel writer Paul Theroux about the parasites that have shared his 30 years of tropical travel. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new spoken word episode of MTV's Unplugged. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has accused Syria of trying to pressure his country. Syria has threatened to cut off peace talks with Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Syria has more than 30,000 troops in Lebanon. Speaking to the Israeli Knesset, Prime Minister Rabin said that Syria is negotiating with Israel on one hand and using its proxy, Hezbollah, to pressure Israel on the other. Rabin said Israel refuses to be pressured. He also sent a message to the hundreds of thousands of Lebanese civilians who have been forced to flee their homes after Israel announced they would be bombed. He told the villagers they would not be able to return to their homes until Hezbollah stops firing Katyusha rockets at northern Israel. Meanwhile, Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk Ashara told a French newspaper that Syria cannot negotiate while Israel is attacking Lebanon. In the 4 days of fighting, more than 50 people have been killed, most in Lebanon, and hundreds injured. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The National Weather Service says that normal summer weather should be returning to the Midwest after more than a month of drenching rains. Weather experts said that a high-pressure area is moving into the Mississippi Valley and that the jet stream is shifting to the north toward its more normal location in the summer. Despite the drier weather, though, people along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers are fearful that record high crests could bring more damage this week and the next. The Army Corps of Engineers warned people in Jamestown, North Dakota, to be ready to evacuate after part of a nearby earthen dam gave way. Coast Guard and fire department workers in Jefferson City, Missouri, have lashed down a storage tank that's been spewing propane gas into the air. Chris Allen of member station KBIA says officials hope the rapid current doesn't trip the tank loose again.
Crews have managed to secure the storage tank to the Highway 54 bridge across the Missouri River and are now waiting for the tank's owners to bring in equipment to move it to a safe place. They hope that will happen by late tonight. Emergency Services Coordinator David Spicer says it appears all the propane has escaped from the tank and they're opening the bridge to emergency traffic. But until they can be sure the danger is over, North Jefferson City will remain evacuated and the bridge will remain closed. Jefferson City is virtually cut off from the northern part of the state. The water is at its highest point in the city's history, with the Capitol building and downtown pretty much cut off from the rest of the city. Only a few major streets remain open, tying traffic in knots. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Allen in Columbia, Missouri.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points to close at 3,553.4. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 4.6 at 705.6. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading of 270 million shares. This is NPR News. Leaders of the three warring sides in Bosnia met today in Geneva, talking directly and without mediators. The direct talks were seen as something of a breakthrough because Bosnia's Muslim president has refused up until now to meet with other leaders on the plan to partition Bosnia along ethnic lines. Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and Croatian leader Franjo Tudjman reportedly also met privately today. The Associated Press quoted sources as saying that the two leaders are working on a plan to define ethnic territories in Bosnia. A new study finds that violence on primetime television has declined slightly over the past 3 years. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The so-called violence index, which researchers at the University of Pennsylvania have been compiling for more than 20 years, measures acts of violence in fictional entertainment programs. And according to the index, the number of those acts has generally declined since 1990. Penn researchers attribute the lower level of violence in part to the 1990 Television Violence Act, which exempts broadcasters from antitrust laws when they take joint action to reduce violence. Senator Paul Simon of Illinois, who sponsored the act, hopes the new study points to a trend toward less violence.
I think for the first time we have reason to hope that the next survey that comes out will show a marked difference rather than a slight decline.
Bowing to a public outcry, the major television networks recently agreed to run warnings at the beginning of violent programs, but critics say much tougher action is needed to curb violent content itself. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
President Clinton said today that the United States is prepared to supply warplanes to help protect peacekeepers in Bosnia if the United Nations requests them. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said today that NATO aircraft should be ready to fly missions in support of the UN peacekeepers early next week. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally on Morning Edition, David Sedaris confides in us, and when he does, it's time to drop what you're doing. Since last Christmas, he's read a series of excerpts from his journals. He told us about his day job as an elf in Macy's Santaland. He told off people who tried to get him to quit smoking. And he explained how he nearly wrote for a magazine geared to men with a fetish for giant-sized women. His writing and delivery are so exceptional, his readings have prompted calls from the supervising producer of Seinfeld, the producers of a couple of soap operas, and a movie company. But how does Sedaris make a living? He cleans houses in Manhattan. He's been writing nights while holding day jobs for years. He was brought to NPR by producer Ira Glass, who saw Sedaris read from his diary in a variety show in Chicago. Before we meet Sedaris, let's hear an excerpt of his Santaland diaries about his job as an elf named Crumpet.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. "22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. She said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired, and I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, this flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden we were surrounded by 5 Santas and 3 other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on, elves and Santas.
David Sedaris from his Santa Land Diaries, as originally broadcast on Morning Edition. He told me about some of the other jobs he's gotten by on over the years.
Probably one of the worst was I picked apples for 3 years in Oregon and New York State, apples and pears. And, you know, you go and you live on a farm, and the farmer puts you up in a shack or a trailer, and you stay for the season, and you pick fruit every day, which is a nice job. But I stayed after the season 1 year, and I got a job at a canning plant, a cannery. And apples and pears would roll down the conveyor belt, and my job was to pick the leaves off the pears, stand there for 8 hours, and pears would roll by me. And then I got promoted, and my job was to separate the fancy from the extra fancy. And nobody ever explained to me the difference.
Yeah, what is the criteria?
When a supervisor is in the area, then you can suddenly discriminate between fancy and extra fancy. But otherwise, you're just in a daze. You just sit there, and every now and then you take an apple or a pear and you put it onto a different conveyor belt. And then the ones that are really bad, you put them down a chute, and they're used for baby food.
How long have you been keeping diaries?
I started when I was 19, so I guess it's been about 17 years.
Do you see yourself as ultimately being a professional writer? I mean, would you like to make a living from your writing, or do you see yourself as holding down day jobs for a long time and just writing at night?
Well, I write in the evening. If I have to write during the daytime, I'll sit down and I'll sit at the typewriter for 2 minutes, and then I'll wonder what my hair might look like parted in the middle. And I go into the bathroom, and I do that. And then I sit back at the typewriter, and then I'll say, I wonder what it would look like if I had a mole on my cheek. I draw a little mole on my cheek, or I go and brush the cat. I can't do it during the day. I don't know why. So I need to do something during the day. And I wouldn't want any kind of a job where I'm sitting down, because then I wouldn't want to come home at night and sit down.
Mm-hmm.
So I like a job that gets me out and is physical and keeps me moving around.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Sedaris. And David, I want to play another one of the commentaries from your journals that was produced for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. And this is your smoking journals. Is there a story behind keeping a journal of this part of your life?
No, usually for the radio, Ira and I will come up with a theme, and mm-hmm. then I'll search for material that relates to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I might record like 20 minutes worth, and then it gets cut down to time.
Right.
So those were just the incidents that made it onto the radio.
Okay, let's hear it.
August 12th, 1992. I rode my bike to the boat pond in Central Park, where I bought myself a cup of coffee and sat down on a bench to read. I lit a cigarette and was enjoying myself when the woman seated 12 feet away on the other side of the bench began waving her arms in front of her face. I thought she was fighting off a bee. She waved her arms and called out, "Excuse me, do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench?" I don't know where to begin with a statement like that. Do you mind if we make this a non-smoking bench? There is no we. Our votes automatically cancel one another out. What she meant was, do you mind if I make this a non-smoking bench? I could understand it if we were on an elevator or locked together in the trunk of a car, but this was outdoors. Who did she think she was? This woman was wearing a pair of sandals that are always a sure sign of trouble. They looked like the sort of shoes Moses would have worn. I looked at her sandals, and I looked at her rapidly moving arms, and I crushed my cigarette. I acted like it was no problem, and then I stared at the pages of my book, hating her and Moses both, the two of them. The trouble with aggressive non-smokers is that they feel they're doing you a favor by not allowing you to smoke. They seem to think that one day you'll thank them for those 15 seconds added to your life. What they don't understand is that is just another 15 seconds I can spend hating their guts and plotting revenge. I sat on the bench and stared at my crushed cigarette. I figured that if I were to leave, it would give her too much pleasure, so I decided to stay and wait her out. My cigarette looked lonesome on the ground, and I promised it that as soon as this woman left, we could spend some time together. I waited. I waited and waited, all the time craving that cigarette. I thought about lighting up again and saying that it was a non-smoking bench for an hour, and now it's a smoking bench. I had suffered, and now it was her turn. That's the we. We suffer. Some of us suffer more than others. Some of us punish ourselves, and some of us punish others. Her sandals punished my eyes, and my cigarette punished hers. I put out my cigarette, but she did not remove her sandals, so I guess she won. May 27th, 1991. My school insurance runs out in a few weeks, so I made an appointment and went for a checkup. I stood around the examining room for 20 minutes, afraid to poke around, as every so often a nurse or some confused patient would open the door and wander into the room. And it's bad enough to be caught in your underpants, but even worse to be caught in your underpants, scratching out a Valium prescription on someone else's pad. When the doctor finally came, he looked over my chart and said, "Hey, we have almost the exact same birthday. I'm one day younger than you." And that does wonders for your morale. He started in by asking some preliminary questions, and then he said, "Do you smoke?" "Only cigarettes and pot," I answered. He gave me a look and said, "Only cigarettes and pot?" "Not crack," I said. "Never touch the stuff. Cigars either. Nasty habit." January 7th, 1993. I was at work defrosting someone's freezer when I heard the EPA's report on secondhand smoke. It was on the radio and they repeated it over and over again. It struck me the same way that previous EPA reports must have struck auto manufacturers and the owners of chemical plants, as reactionary and unfair. The report indicts smokers, especially smoking parents, as being guilty of criminal recklessness, as if these were people who kept loaded pistols lying on the coffee table, crowded alongside straight razors and mugs of benzene. Over Christmas, we looked through boxes of family pictures and played Find Mom, Find the Cigarette. There's one in every picture. We've got photos of her pregnant, leaning towards a lit match, and others of her posing with the newborn baby, the smoke forming a halo above our heads. It gave us a warm feeling, these pictures. She smoked in the bathtub where we'd find her drowned butts lined in a neat row beside the shampoo bottle. She smoked through meals and often used her plate as an ashtray, explaining that we should not attempt to perform this trick in public. Mom's theory was that if you cook the meal and do the dishes, then you're allowed to use your plate however you like. It made sense to us. Even after she was diagnosed with lung cancer, she continued to smoke, though less often. On her final trip to the hospital, sick with pneumonia, she told my father she'd left something at home and had him turn the car around. And there, standing at the kitchen counter, she entertained what she knew to be her last cigarette. And I hoped that she enjoyed it. It never occurred to any of us that my mother might quit smoking. Picturing her without a cigarette was like imagining her on water skis. All of us are left to choose our own quality of life and take pleasure where we find it, with the understanding that, like Mom used to say, sooner or later, something's going to get you. Something got me the moment I returned home from work and Hugh delivered his interpretation of the EPA report. He tells me that I'm no longer allowed to smoke in any room which he currently occupies. Our apartment is small, four tiny rooms. I told him that seeing as I pay half the rent, I should be allowed to smoke half the time we're in the same room. He agreed on the condition that every time I light a cigarette, all the windows must be open. It's cold outside.
That's David Sedaris, a commentary originally heard on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Now, do you talk to strangers with the kind of intimacy that you speak on the radio about your personal experiences? Or even talk to friends that way? Or does radio bring out something very personal in you?
No. I think radio is just a little bit more, you know, when you're on the radio, people don't know what you look like and you're just a voice. So there's something there for people to imagine. And your friends know what you look like. And you've sat around with your friends boring them for years. And there's no mystery there.
David Sedaris will be back with us after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sedaris. He reads from his diaries on NPR's Morning Edition. Now, I really like the way you read. Are you an actor?
No, I've been in a couple plays before, but when I'm on stage, I never know what to do with my hands. And I always wind up putting them in my pocket. It doesn't matter what it is I'm supposed to be doing at the moment. I'm thinking, what do I do with my hands? What do I do with my hands? So I can be on stage if I have a piece of paper in front of me, but you take the paper away and I'm a mess. I was, growing up, I had like dozens of nervous habits. My teachers would only send notes home to my mother saying that maybe you should come in and we can talk about David's special problems. I would roll my eyes back into my head. That was one of them. You know, you probably met people like that. They have to close their eyes really intensely and for about 10 seconds at a pop. And another one was to shake my head, just sort of jerk my head so I could feel my brain rattling around. It felt so good to me. And I had, or... I would be in class and I had to make some kind of noise with my throat. And gradually, the habits sort of faded away. And the first time I got on stage, they all came back. Just before I went on stage, I thought, boy, I remember when I used to do that with my head. And I got on stage, and afterwards, people said, what happened out there? I said, oh, it was the lights, you know, they're so bright. The lights caused me to do that. If I think about all those habits can return to me. All I have to do is think about them at any given time.
Here they come. well, I guess it was. It must have been pretty frightening to be on stage and feel out of control with all these old habits overtaking you.
Oh, terrifying. And they can come back at any moment. That's what's so frightening about it. Like even now, if it'll just visit me, the thought, oh, I remember when I used to jerk my head around, and then there it'll be back.
I bet you're very good at impressions. In your Sandaland diaries, you do a version of Away in a Manger, as it might have been sung by Billie Holiday, had she put out a Christmas album late in her life. And you really have it down, that the older Billie Holiday style.
When I was young, my dad has a great record collection, and he was giving me Billie Holiday records like in the third grade. And I especially love her very towards the very end. But what's so great about Billie Holiday, too, is that she would never put out a Christmas album.
Oh, exactly. I know. Well, precisely.
Like I could never sing, even in my fantasies, I could never sing Strange Fruit. I could never sing a song that Billie Holiday actually sang because that would be a sacrilege.
Let me play the part of the journal that you recorded for NPR in which you did Away in a Manger as sung as Billie Holiday would have sung it had she recorded a Christmas album in the latter part of her life.
Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head.
Are there any impressions you can do for us of other singers?
I could never do Billie Holiday doing any of the songs that she does that she would have done because that would be sort of a sacrilege to me. And then you would have something directly to compare it to. But I like Billie Holiday singing like the Madonna songbook.
'Cause I am living in a material world, and I am a material girl.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely surreal.
That's okay?
Yes.
Because if it doesn't sound good, I would, you know.
No, it's good. How did you start? What made you start doing things that were wildly inappropriate for Billie Holiday to sing? I mean, you know why it works so well? Billie Holiday's older voice is just, it's so kind of drenched in emotion, mm-hmm. and everything that she's been through. And her voice is shot, but her timing is perfect. And anyway, so how did you start doing absolutely inappropriate material for her?
I was just walking down the street one day, and I started doing it. I can't remember the first song. I think maybe it was Up, Up, and Away or something like that. It was.
Oh.
And I would just listen to the radio and think, well, what if she had done this song? And what was so great about her was that she didn't do any of those songs. The songs that she did, Billie Holiday doing, let's say, a Madonna song, reminds you how lousy the lyrics to Madonna songs are. Or to most songs that you hear on the radio.
Yeah.
Except country songs, I think that they still have a lot of good lyrics in them.
You know, when you're doing a day job like cleaning, does it affect your like sense of yourself, your identity? Are you able to say, well, you know, I'm a writer, I make my living cleaning, or do you think, oh, gosh, I'm going to be cleaning the rest of my life. I really wanted to be a writer, and I'm just stuck here cleaning. Some people it really gets to when they have a day job that doesn't fit with what it is that they really, really want to be doing.
Well, I mean, like I said, I write in the evening, so, I mean, I guess I could stay home all during the day and then say, well, I'm a writer now, but I don't really see the point.
Uh-huh.
And the cleaning part of it, I like to think that all work is pretty much equal. It doesn't really matter what you do. It doesn't bother me, the work. I like it. There's a before and an after. I mean, I like cleaning someone's home if they're really filthy. That's my favorite. But some of the people I clean for, it's clean when I get there. And there's really not that much for me to do. So you don't feel like there's a before and an after. So I'd much rather go to a slob's house and because afterwards they look at it like you've done something they could never possibly do, like you have retuned the engine to their car, like it was something that took, or you have removed their kidney, like you did something that required such skill, and it was a skill that they could never ever master. Anyone can plug in a trained chimp could vacuum an apartment.
Well, David Sedaris, it's really been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Sedaris writes and cleans houses in New York. He reads from his diaries on NPR's Morning Edition. His next reading will be about cleaning houses, and it's likely to run next week. Our thanks to his producer, Ira Glass. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seam of anyone's dream is over my head. Do nothing.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bye.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We don't want to put a damper on your vacation, but coming up, some world travel anecdotes not for the squeamish. We'll talk with travel writer Paul Theroux about something he's left out of his travel books, the insects and parasites that have afflicted him with fevers, boils, the runs, and other awful things. Don't dismay, he thinks none of this should stand in the way of travel, but he does have some precautions to suggest. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new MTV Unplugged episode featuring a group of New York poets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has called on both Israel and the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon to stop their fighting. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
President Clinton's comments underscored the State Department's criticism of Israel for firing on civilian targets in Lebanon. Israel maintains its attacks are justified retaliation for the fundamentalist group Hezbollah's killing of Israeli soldiers. The president urged all parties in the region to work to get the stalled Middle East peace talks back on track.
I think Hezbollah should stop its attacks. I think Israel should stop the bombardments. I think that Syria should go from showing restraint to being an active participant to try to stop the fighting, and we ought to do whatever we can to stop the fighting as quickly as possible.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who cut short a visit to Asia because of the renewed fighting in Lebanon, plans to return to the Middle East next week. He's hoping to get the peace talks started again in August. Christopher plans to visit Egypt, Israel, Syria, and Jordan. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Capitol Hill, the House has approved President Clinton's National Service Plan after cutting tuition money that college students would get for performing public service jobs. Critics said the plan would make it harder to get military recruits if superior benefits were given in the National Service Program. The vote in the House for approval was 275 to 152. Mr. Clinton welcomed the vote, and he urged Republican senators to, in his words, put partisan politics aside and vote for the measure. Weather officials in Iowa say that a jet stream is starting to move to the north, carrying with it rain that has been soaking the Midwest for the past several months. But farming officials in the state say it's far too late to save most crops and fields. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
This is the wettest spring and summer in Iowa's history, and the state is finally getting some relief, but not before the worst natural disaster in Iowa's history did at least $3 billion in damage. State agriculture official Bob Furley calls the summer of 1993 a great tragedy.
My own assessment on my farm is that half of my corn in Sargota County will probably not achieve maturity by average killing frost date, so that it could be harvested as grain and dried and sold in the marketplace.
State economists say Iowa will lose at least $700 million in agriculture damage alone. Farmers are now pinning their hopes on the U.S. Senate to pass a flood relief bill. Even if President Clinton signs the $4.1 billion in disaster relief, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad says that will not be nearly enough to help people here restore their lives. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 12 points to close at 3,553.45 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, after a day when government troops are said to have suffered some of their heaviest losses, near the capital, shelling of Sarajevo eased a bit. Yesterday, Serbian factions forced government forces out of some of their positions on a mountain near the capital. In northern Bosnia, continued shelling is reported, and a large number of residents are heading south. Serbian forces, who now hold about 70% of Bosnia, are trying to enlarge a path linking their land in eastern and western sections of the nation. President Clinton said today that the U.S. will seriously consider using air power in Bosnia if called upon to defend U.N. peacekeepers. In New York City, U.N. Secretary General Boutros-Ghali says that he expects the U.N. to be in a position to carry out airstrikes in Bosnia by Monday or Tuesday of next week. His statement follows an urgent request by France for U.N. action after attacks on its peacekeepers. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports from the U.N.
Secretary General Boutros Ghali says that by early next week, advanced air controllers should be in position in Bosnia to guide NATO airstrikes against gunners who attack UN peacekeepers. Until now, the UN has been concerned that any action against Bosnia Serbs would invite retaliation on UN peacekeepers and further involve the world body in the conflict. But today, Boutros Ghali played down such fears, saying that the airstrikes would be limited. UN officials are hoping that a narrow and focused response won't lead to an escalation of the fighting. However, as of now, it's still unclear just how ready the UN is to use force against the Serbs. There's speculation that this latest initiative is aimed more at pressuring the Serbs to be flexible at the peace talks in Geneva than in deepening the UN's involvement in the Bosnian conflict. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I don't know about you, but before I travel, I always worry I'm coming down with something. Maybe I shouldn't have read Paul Theroux's article in the July edition of the Condé Nast Traveler. It's called Parasites I Have Known, and it's about the many afflictions he's picked up from parasites and insects in his 30 years of travel through the tropics. But since I did read it, I thought I should share it with you. After all, who knows where you're heading on your summer vacation? Paul Theroux is one of our most popular travel writers. He's spending his summer writing at his home on Cape Cod. He told me he always leaves his illnesses out of his travel books.
I leave these diseases out of travel books because I don't find them particularly interesting to write about if I'm writing about a landscape or a place. To talk about your illnesses is really drawing excessive attention to yourself. The great place for writing about diseases is in fiction, in short stories. And in each of the diseases that I mentioned in my article, I have actually used for a story. For example, the one called Putsy Fly Fever, where the flies lay eggs on your shirt and then they hatch and the worms burrow into your skin and then you have these worms in your skin. I wrote about in a story called White Lies, which is in a collection called World's End. Dengue fever, I wrote a story called Dengue Fever. Leprosy, which I haven't had, but I worked in a leper colony, I wrote about in a poem and then in another story. So eventually they find their way into print.
Why are diseases good for fiction?
I think because they're very, very dramatic. And when you think about the diseases that occur in fiction, like the plague, the Albert Camus novel, or the death of Ivan Illich, the Tolstoy short story, or Burnt Out Case, or I was recently reading a book called Christ Stopped at Eboli, and there's a lot of illness in that. It's just marvelous, I think, because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's about mortality. But a travel book, when people write about their diarrhea in travel books or the illnesses, I find it in the same class as writing about standing in line. You know, sometimes people complain about standing in line at the embassy waiting for a visa, standing in line waiting for a ticket, or the rudeness of people in lines, or time passing. I don't think there's anything in it. I think people don't want to hear about it. And so I made a practice never to write about it. So I've never written about illnesses in my travel books. I think six, some fairly substantial books. But when I came to write an article about it, I saw a whole feast of, that's the word.
No, I think you were the feast.
That's true. But they are, I think also, to be serious, that when I went to Africa in 1963, when I joined the Peace Corps, I remember a professor, he was a science professor, I think a biologist, was lecturing us on tropical illnesses, and he said, he was describing, I think it was African eye worm, where it's really terrible because you can actually see the worm in your eye as it's sort of creeping across your eye. And that's how you know you have it. And he was describing snake bite and so forth. And he said, well, you're going to be off next month to Nyasaland, as it was called, Central Africa. And we said, yeah, don't you wish you could come? And he said, I wouldn't go there for any amount of money. And we said, why? And he said, it's full of insects, snakes, and he said, I just wouldn't do it. And he said, I'm staying in Syracuse, New York, thanks very much. And I thought, there are people who stay home because of illnesses, but I wouldn't dream of staying home because of an illness, since you can overcome or prevent most illnesses.
Did you ever have African eye worm?
No, I had my students had it. That's pretty terrible. You get it from swimming in certain stagnant pools. And the thing, one rule of thumb, which this is how you stay healthy, certain rules of thumb, never swim. Never swim in Africa is a good rule. Don't swim in fresh water anyway. Swim in the ocean. Another one is don't drink water. Don't drink unboiled water. It's quite an easy one. In India, don't eat meat. It's usually a good idea to keep to the habits of the local people. If everyone's a Hindu vegetarian, you'll be a Hindu vegetarian and you'll be better off. No one would be worse at cooking meat than a vegetarian.
Let me just ask you, this African eye worm, is it a hallucination that you're seeing the worm crawl across your eye, or are you seeing really a worm crawl across your eye?
Oh, no. There is a worm. The worm actually gets into your eye and it creeps across it. And it can be plucked out, but by a medical procedure. No, it's there. And the same thing is true with the worms that the putsi fly, they're called tumbu flies also, but putsi was the local language. They actually did, the fly lays its eggs on a shirt that's on the line. And unless that shirt is ironed, but with a very hot iron, the eggs hatch. They hatch with the warmth of your skin when you're wearing the shirt. And the eggs immediately, this is, you know, survival instinct of the little worm. Putsi means worm in Chinyanja. The worm gets into your skin and it stays there. It hatches there. So they have to be gotten out of your skin.
Well, you write about this in your article, and to me it was an image out of a Clive Barker story. I mean, you had boils all over your body. You popped one of the boils and a little maggot crawled out. I mean, I'd be mortified.
Yeah, my short story, White Lies, has it in more detail. But it's a grotesque thing to have. It's fairly painful when they're removed. They're not, the boils themselves are just, well, they're boils. But it is terrible. It is terrible. But when you think about it, it's very dramatic and weird and the stuff of fiction. It's almost worth going through just to have something to write about. But, I mean, the same is true of most travel writing. Misery makes for good travel.
If you're just joining us, my guest is travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux. He's joining us from his home in Cape Cod. And we're talking about the subject of an article in the current edition of the Condé Nast Traveler magazine. His article is called Parasites I Have Known. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Theroux is my guest, and he has written a recent article called Parasites I Have Known about illnesses that he's come down with while he was traveling, the kinds of things he leaves out of his travel books. You write that the worst fever you ever had was while you were in a leper colony. I don't know whether you were writing about it or working there, but what kind of fever did you have?
No one knew. That's another thing. The tropical world is full of nameless fevers. What happens is you simply run a high fever, a high temperature, and collapse, and then you sweat. And people try various things. They try aspirin. They try chloroquine, which is for malaria. They make you drink a lot of liquids, or if you're alone, you drink a lot of liquids. And then if you've got a good constitution, you might survive. But it could be anything. It could be malaria. It could be black water fever. It could be cholera. It could be so many things giving you a high fever that there's any number of reasons why you could have this high fever. And you may get rid of it, be cured of it in a week or so, and never know what you had. That's the strange thing. You might have been bitten, you might have drunk something or whatever. And I think the high fever, having a high fever in a hot country is also pretty terrible. Anyway, the prospect of getting an illness shouldn't stop anyone from going abroad. And it's even rather an interesting speculation if you go to a place and you say, well, there are these diseases there. How can I prevent myself from getting it?
What do you do when you're visiting a place that you haven't been to before, to find out what the local diseases and parasites are and how you can protect yourself from it?
I try to talk to somebody who's been there. And if I can't find anyone who's been there, I read as much as possible. I'm a great reader of guidebooks, not travel books, although I write them. I need hard information. For example, the scourge of the world today, I suppose AIDS is a scourge, but malaria is really one of the most serious ones, because malaria is very, very hard to prevent. And that's one, generally speaking, if you're going to New Guinea or Africa, parts of South America, lots of places, not only is there a lot of malaria in these places, but it's of a particularly virulent kind. Other things you can prevent, venereal disease, you can prevent by simply abstaining. AIDS, you abstain. Lots of other things you abstain. But the malaria, there's no amount of abstention can prevent it. So what would I do? I bought the best tent money can buy that has a mosquito net in it. When people in villages in New Guinea, and I was recently in Malawi, when people say, sleep in the hut, you know, come, enjoy our hospitality, I politely decline and say, I'll sit around and have a drink with you, but then I think I'll have my little tent. This is in a village. So carrying your little mosquito-proof tent with you is a very good way of doing it, and also staying in it after dark, getting up early, and because mosquitoes tend to bite at night, in the early morning, and in the evening, and not during the day.
What about insect repellents? Are they any good to ward off the mosquitoes that carry malaria?
They're all right, but in these places it's usually so hot you're perspiring and they wear off. They also smell like hell. I use them. I spray them, but you need insect repellent in Florida, off, you know, the islands off the west coast of Florida. There are a lot of no-see-ums and insects and so forth. I was recently in a place where there were no mosquitoes, a tropical place, the Republic of Palau. I was on an island and there were no mosquitoes whatsoever. I woke up in the middle of the night, walked around. I was stark naked, and I walked from my tent down. There was a full moon glowing on the water. There was no wind and no mosquitoes. I've never been in a tropical place where there were no insects. There were no flies either.
Why not?
I don't know. I asked several people. They said, oh, yeah, well, no, there aren't a lot there. They said sometime on some of the islands there are, but I think because there's no standing water, mosquitoes breed in standing water, and if there isn't, fresh water where they can lay eggs, this place is so dry at that time of the year, and there's no people, only 15,000 people, and there's 340 islands. I will say, though, that I don't mean to interrupt, but there's one. I was standing there, marveling at my luck that there were no insects, and I heard kind of rustling, and I had a flashlight, and I shone it on the beach, and there were about 20 rats. so you can congratulate
yourself. Now, isn't that reassuring?
And rats aren't bad. They were rooting around because I had some food that I hadn't hung up high enough. Rat urine is a very bad thing. You can get leptospirosis from that.
What do you take with you in your medical kit when you travel?
I have a thermometer. I bring antibiotics. I bring antibiotic cream, bandages, things like needles, things for pulling out thorns, and in the Pacific, sea urchins are a problem. You might get very, very bad splinter from them, and they can get infected. Or just bumping coral. Let's say you're paddling, you're snorkeling and paddling through, and you bump your knee or your leg against some coral. That's the chances of that getting infected are about 99%.
What?
I think just because there's such a high bacterial content in the coral, in the water, and then in the place. It's bacterial infections kill people all over the Pacific and Africa and in the tropical world, let's say. So they're not, people die very young. I mean, in New Guinea, a person who's got to the age of 45 or 50 is a very, very old man or old woman. And, the childbearing years are in their mid to late teens. So that life expectancy is very low because of bacterial infections and malaria, of course. Anyway, the coral bump is a very, very bad thing. And there's almost nothing you can do about it. You can put a lot of antibacterial ointment on it and bandage it and so forth. But the chances are that you'll have to see a doctor and get an injection of some kind.
Should this interview discourage people from going anyplace?
No. On the contrary. No one should not go to a place because they hear that they might catch something or that there's a prevalent disease. What they should do is read as much as they can about the place, consult a doctor, talk to people who've gone there, and then go. Illness, unless it's bubonic plague, or the water is totally undrinkable, or there's some blight on the landscape. I can't think of there aren't many things that would prevent me from going. You have to be very, very careful, but the fear of catching an illness shouldn't keep anyone at home. I think it kept people home in the past. A long time ago, people thought that the night air was bad for you. They still think that in Ecuador. If you breathe the night air, it's kind of malaria, malaria, bad air. But that shouldn't be the case. It really shouldn't be the case. We're smarter, and abstention and prevention can keep you pretty healthy.
I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry.
And enjoy the summer.
Okay, thank you very much.
Travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux spoke to us from his home on Cape Cod. His article, Parasites I Have Known, is in the July edition of the Condé Nast Traveler. This is Fresh Air. Fighting continues in southern Lebanon. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will we have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. President Bill Clinton is calling for peace between Hezbollah guerrillas and Israel fighting in southern Lebanon, and he wants Syria to take an active role in bringing about that peace. Also tonight, Ann Garrels reports on the possibility of NATO air power, including U.S. warplanes, being used to come to the rescue of United Nations personnel in Bosnia, which might be in difficulty there. Ann will report on the death of Boston Celtics basketball star Reggie Lewis. He collapsed on a practice basketball court yesterday at age 27. And the somewhat mysterious Mrs. Sweeney has died. She was featured in Cole Porter's song, You're the Top.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The MTV series Unplugged has provided an acoustic showcase for Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, REM, and many others. Tonight, the show takes its minimalistic approach one step further and devotes an entire program to young poets and their poetry. MTV is calling it a spoken word edition of Unplugged. Critic David Bianculli has a review.
Yes, it's true. Maynard G. Krebs is alive and well and living on MTV. The setting for Spoken Word is a recreation of a typical coffee house from the 50s. But the mood isn't totally authentic, because the audience applauds after each performance instead of snapping their fingers and nodding their heads. And instead of using bongos as backup, some of the poets rely on music by a group called Huge Voodoo. The best modern beatnik in the group is Maggie Estep, who dresses in black, the official color of aspiring artists then and now. She's also barefoot and loud and not afraid to repeat herself. Here's a sample from her poem, The Stupid Jerk I'm Obsessed With.
Because he is the stupid jerk I'm obsessed with, and he is obsessed with doing anything he can to lend fuel to my fire. He makes a point of standing, looking over my shoulder when I'm talking to the guy who adores me and would bark like a dog and wave to strangers if I asked him to bark like a dog and wave to strangers. But I can't ask him to bark like a dog or impersonate any kind of animal at all, because I'm too busy looking at the way the stupid jerk I'm obsessed with has pants on that perfectly define his well-shaped ass to the point where I'm thoroughly frantic. I'm just gonna go.
One guy, Bob Holman, is heckled by somebody in the audience as he performs, which saved me the trouble. Another, punk singer and performer Henry Rollins, takes a few nibbles at the hand that's feeding him in a poem called Ode to MTV Unplugged. However, it earns more points for its message than its poetry.
Oh, MTV Unplugged, I hope you keep our minds well bugged. Sometimes while watching the Big M, I become so bored, viewing videos from the horde, bare-chested men who wax poetic, saying things that sound prophetic. It all makes me say, how pathetic.
I know this stuff is the new cool thing, but I have a low threshold for poetry that's 80% pretension. Few of these poems hold up to repeated listenings, and some are bad enough the first time. But there is one breakout poet here, Reggie Gaines, whose poem is as powerful as his dedication to it. Here's how Gaines starts out.
I'd like to kick this poem for Spike, Mike, and for all the black kids that have been killed over these $200 sneakers. Yeah. This is called Please Don't Take My Air Jordans.
And here's a piece of the poem.
They was Q-tip white bright and blind in my eyes. The red emblem of Michael whoosh, looked as if it could fly. Not one spot of dirt, the airs were brand new. Had my pistol, knew just what to do. Followed him very closely behind. Waited until it was just the right time. Made a left turn on House and pulled out my gun and said, give me them Jordans. And he tried to run. Took off fast, didn't get far. I fired, pow! He fell between two parked cars. He was coughing, crying, blood dripped on the street. And I snatched them Air Jordans off of his feet. While laying there dying, all he could say was, please, don't take my Air Jordans away. You'd think he'd be worried about staying alive. As I took off with the Jordans, there was tears in his eyes. Very next day, I bopped into school with my brand new Air Jordans. Man, was I cool! I killed to get them, but hey, I don't care. Because now, I need a new jacket to wear.
It was MTV that carried rap music into the mainstream, and spoken word is the next logical step. This particular step, on a network where Air Jordan ads are seen almost as often as Aerosmith, is another bold one for Unplugged. It's not a rich banquet of ideas, but it does serve up a few tasty hors d'oeuvres.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistants from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, bringing down New York's mob boss, John Gotti, we talk with retired New York City cop Remo Franceschini. He spent over 30 years tracking organized crime in New York and personally wiretapped Gotti's office. Also, playwright and drag star Charles Bush. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.